accession number 27183, reel number 3.
Major Neave, reel 3. I was asking about the Brigadier, Brigadier Mullen, I think it was.
He was one of these sort of silent men. I really had very little to do with him. I remember he had an enormous jaw. I always thought he was a bit thick, but perfectly nice. And not a very dynamic chap at all. I think his son has been a very successful senior general.
Well, why did he fall out with Hobart? What was there?
I don't know.
You don't know?
Mm. I should think Hobart was highly dynamic and what was his Christian name? Jack, was it? Mullins was anything but dynamic.
So it would be a clash of personalities.
I would think probably, yeah. And I don't know. I don't know.
You talked about the Mid-Hope tank gunnery ranges. What sort of shooting did you do?
well, target shooting, really. Very little, mostly stationary. Oh. But they were quite difficult to use, the rather useless 2-pounder gun. We used to go down to Lilyhead too, of course.
Yes, firing camp in Wales.
That was much, I think, a much better training for gunnery than.
What could you do at Lilyhead that you couldn't do at Mid-Hope?
Well, we could move much more freely. What was it called?
Mid-Hope.
Mid-Hope was on the moors and pretty sort of bad weather, I seem to remember. I think it was pretty miserable out there. And couldn't really move about, but you could fire your guns, and it was not easy to find somewhere where you could fire a 2-pounder. And so to that extent it was valuable. It got people shooting and knowing what it was like to be in a tank that was firing, because it was quite a powerful explosion.
What about using the machine gun, the secondary armament? Did you do that in the same ranges? You could do that
on the ranges too. The Browning machine gun was a very good gun, and although it was nothing like as rapid as the Spandau, and the German armaments were far superior to us in every department, far superior. Both the vehicles, the tanks, and the gunnery left us standing.
Were you aware of that while you were doing this training, before you met them?
No.
Did you get any briefings or pamphlets about the German army and its equipment and its tactics? And
I don't remember much of that, I must say. I don't remember getting that kind of briefing.
When you were on the larger exercises, were they opposed? Did you have an enemy to?
Sort of. But, I mean, it was pretty sketchy.
Skeleton enemy.
Yes.
You were saying in your book that eventually the commanding officer and squadron leaders went up to Barnard Castle to learn the a new role of infantry support. Did you go on that course with them?
No, I didn't. No.
Did you happen to know what they learned and what they were told up there?
No, I seem to remember that it was regarded as being pretty useful. But at the same time, I think it was not really expected that our role would be an I-tank role. But of course it turned out to be all the time.
Direct support of infantry in an assault is very much an I-tank role.
Yes.
Do you think we had the right sort of tank for that?
We never had the right sort of tank for anything. The tanks we did have in Normandy were their huge benefit to us was their reliability. A diesel Sherman tank went on and on and on, and was wonderfully reliable. But I mean, its armament, a 75-pound gun, was no match for the German 77.
What about the Firefly, the 17-pounder? Was that?
That was good. I mean, that would knock out a Tiger tank if it hit it in the right place. But that was all right. But it wasn't ideally mounted on a Sherman tank. It fairly shook the thing about it.
When you were doing your big exercises, did you ever have close cooperation with infantry?
Yes, but not in quite the same way as it turned out to be in Normandy. I mean, it's all the difference in the world, cooperating with infantry and not being shot at.
It's not possible to simulate being shot at, is it?
No.
You know?
No.
How were you taught to actually cooperate with them then on the in the training exercises?
Well, I mean, you started off with a plan, and I don't think there was anything really too specific about it. I mean,
were you generally allocated one troop to a company or something
like that?
Entirely
depended. I mean, a squadron was usually in support of a battalion.
So it would be a troop per company, wouldn't it?
A troop and a company.
Presumably one tank per platoon.
That sort of thing. It very seldom worked out quite as precisely as that.
And was the idea that in an advanced contact the tanks and infantry would be intermingled, or would it generally be better to have them on separate axes?
Difficult to say. I would think it was... it depended on the terrain very much, whether it was in close country or in open country or in a village or in a town even.
Did you ever exercise over any terrain in Britain that resembled what you met in Normandy?
When we were in Suffolk, stationed at Wickham Market, there was a battle area where there were two villages, one called Icon and one called Boot, on the way to Orford, were isolated, and we were allowed, very light country now, we were allowed to drive through and shoot anything and anybody and anywhere. And that was very valuable because it meant that you could really test the vehicles out and the ability to do what had to be done. And it taught one really that stationary shooting was the only... I mean, all very well to say you could fire on the move, but I mean, it was... It might have frightened them, but it wouldn't... You couldn't have done much more.
Did anyone ever really believe in firing on the move?
Oh, I think they did, you see. I think they thought that you would be able to fire on the move. In fact, we trained firing on the move quite a lot, but it was... in point of hitting the target, it on.
What about the machine gun? Was that useful?
Well, that was very useful for making the opposition keep its head down. Yeah. I mean, that was the great thing. In the Bocage in Normandy, I think Derek Wormald was a great exponent of this. He would loose off an immense amount of ammunition because he'd kept people's head down. I mean, when the range was only about the end of this room, to let off a blast of Browning fire into the hedge in front was absolutely the way to get forward.
You'd have two machine guns, wouldn't you? The hull machine gun and the turret.
And the coaxial one. I think firepower was a very good lesson.
And you learned that on this exercise in Suffolk?
Yes, we did that at Lilyhead and these other places. But of course, in the event, none of that country was really like the Bocage.
Yeah. It's much more open, isn't it,
much
up in Suffolk?
Open, much more open.
You mentioned an exercise called SET, I think, which you said was a brigade level. It was a good exercise. I think this was in July 1943.
Yes.
Do you remember what that was about? What the aim of it was and what sort of things you did?
I really don't remember about that.
You also mentioned that when the new brigadier arrived, Brigadier Prior Palmer, things started to get a bit rough. An inspection.
Well, I think he was a pretty lively chap.
Yes.
And I think he set about making sure that things were going to be moving along. He wasn't everybody's choice, but he was pretty good, I think, really.
What sort of things particularly interested him? Of course, you said that your CO was interested in making sure everyone got their training and techniques and procedures absolutely right, maximise mechanical efficiency and going on from there. But what about Brigadier Prior Palmer? What were his priorities?
Well, speaking really from memory, I would think movement was really what... He was a great one for making sure that... traffic discipline and road drills for movement were good, and we used to do quite a great deal of movement around. He had a great expression I remember called cattle trucking.
What does that mean?
Which meant that columns would get bunched up and like a train and shuddering like this, and of course it was difficult moving huge columns on small roads and keeping distances, and one could see the vast damage that was caused by with the German columns retreating, that if the airplane dropped a bomb on the leading tank and then strafed the column behind it, for colossal damage was done, and how the discipline of was vital. And I think Errol taught us a lot about that. And
Had he had personal experience of that sort of thing?
I don't think so. He was a cameraman, I think. Yes. But I think he saw the necessity of being able to move large units and formations around.
It must be rather difficult to keep distances if you're moving on the sort of twisting roads that you have in Essex and Suffolk.
Very difficult. It wasn't easy.
Is there anything you can do to make it easier than it is inherently? Or was it just a matter of
practice,
experience and judgment?
Judgment, experience, and practice, I think. And it used to, sometimes it used to go very wrong. But changing slightly, coming back to the DD side of it, there were... the great exercises that we had up at Fort George, in Inverness. Are you coming on to that, or am I jumping the gun too much?
No, carry on.
The great benefit there, again, it all got to do with columns and movement and the difficulty of controlling these things. But what it taught one was that the chaos involved in landing from the sea onto a shore, and then getting off the shore and some coherent movement would always involve almost total chaos. And so, having done this three or four times in the north of Scotland in midwinter, to do it on the actual day in June in France, the chaos was about the same. And I mean, you were used to it. It was something that you expected. You didn't expect just to drive off the sea and straight in. And the fact that you were actually being shot at too was merely an added complication. It was very, very difficult to land and get off the shore without any opposition at all.
Did you find that some members of the regiment found it difficult to accept the idea that chaos was natural? Did they try and bring order out of chaos on exercises?
I think that it was the facts of the case were very plain and clear to see.
And they had to get used to it.
And they just got used to it.
Mm. Did you find it difficult to adjust to the idea of chaos being natural and inevitable?
It's frustrating, but my role, of course, was one that spent most of my time on the end of a wireless sense and trying to get information back as to what was happening and get orders out as to what should happen next. And by and large, the radio worked. I mean, nothing like as efficient as it would have been now.
My cadets would tell you a different story.
What would they say?
They would say that it always fails when you need it most.
Yes. That's probably true, but it was quite a complicated business. We had a sort of forward link and the rear link. Yes. And the rear link was normally run by the second in command, and the forward link was run by me, the adjutant, through the colonel.
So you were going down to the squadron.
Mm.
Could you speak directly to troops? You didn't have a regimental net?
No. You sometimes had a regimental net, but basically that would have been too complicated, because you had your gunners and your infantry with who were on the net too, plus almost certainly that other people with whom you were involved.
How many stations would you normally have to handle then when you are on the forward link?
Can't remember. Not all that number, perhaps 10.
That's an awful lot of...
awful lot.
Yes.
Mm. Perhaps I'm wrong there. I don't know. I can't be too positive.
It must have been some concentration on instilling radio discipline.
Amusing stories of pressing the pressel switch and letting out a string of oaths, which were then broadcast round the place.
How far could your sets transmit? What was the reliable, normal range of the set?
2 or 3 miles.
Well, that would be enough, wouldn't it, for most purposes?
Yes. Yeah.
Where would you normally like regimental headquarters to be in terms of distance from the forward squadrons?
Well, you probably were in between. You might have 2 forward squadrons or one forward squadron and 2 behind you and 2 in front of you, you know, dependent. No 2 ops were ever the same remotely. They were almost always quite different.
Well, presumably there was a distance which you would normally take up behind the leading.
Yes. Well, sometimes, you'd have to... the whole squadron would be detached and out of your control. Mm. And that used to happen a certain amount that
we didn't have any direct control over
in some operations.
Now, you mentioned an incident in training when Lieutenant Smith's tank ran out of petrol on the lake at Fritton.
Yes.
What happened to him? Did he have did his subsequent career flourish, or was it blighted?
His career flourished. I mean, it wasn't held against him. I mean, it was quite enough. The ignominy and the jokes were enough to...
How did you actually manage to refuel when the tank was sort of bobbing about on the water? It must have been a rather tricky operation.
I honestly can't remember. I don't know what happened there. Mind you, they were not the tanks that we used. I mean, they were Valentine tanks,
yes,
which were the ones that were used for the experimental use of
yes.
For the DD things.
And you also mentioned there was a tense morning in a launch with General Bradley,
yes,
and
that was in the Solent,
Admiral Vian and General Hobart. What was causing the tension? Was it just that they hadn't had their breakfast?
Yes.
It was.
Yes.
There was no disagreement about a matter of military substance.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. It was just early morning liver, I think.
Did you get any sort of impression of Bradley?
Yes, I think a wrong impression. He looked, by comparison with the others, a rather miserable little man. And I think, in fact, he was a tough nut.
Did he get on all right with the other two, with Hobart and Vian?
Well, I only saw them for such a short time that I wouldn't know.
You said that when you went up to Scotland after training in the Solent, that you were able to develop your own ideas about handling DD tanks. That you were tied to what you call the school version, I think.
I mean, the school version was a very untried one.
Yes.
We had now got experience in how they did handle and what they were capable of and what they couldn't do. And so, I mean, one developed one's own techniques, and one taught oneself, and there was no... we were far in advance of anything that the schools had.
Well, what sort of things would you do differently than the way the schools wanted things done?
Difficult to say. I mean, I think it was handling them actually in the conditions of the water, of the sea was rough. One knew one couldn't do this and you couldn't do that. And I mean, after all, whatever they taught us, a lot of it was supposition.
Theory. And they weren't amenable to advice from...
Well, we didn't... I mean, that wasn't a factor.
Do you remember anything about the series of exercises you did up in Scotland? You mentioned a whole series of code names: Smash, Crown, Anchor, and Leap Year. Do you remember anything in detail about what happened on those? How they were carried out?
They were all very much the same. I mean, we used to be picked up on the Hards at Fort George from the LCTs that had come over from Fort Rose, and we'd steam out to sea for a certain length of time, then turn round and then advance on the shore of Birkenhead Bay, the mouth of the Findhorn River, and each time it was really roughly the same. And one incident, which was really rather a tragic one, was when on the LCT that I was on, which the Colonel, Tom Melton Barrett, was on, one of the sailors got caught in the winch handle and he was in fact killed as the thing swung round. And Tom was desperately trying to extract him from this thing, and he strained himself in some way which set up a recurrence of a sickness which he'd had when serving with the 4th 7th, I think, in India. And he became so sick that he had to give up the command of the regiment for D-Day, which was for a very ambitious and very competent soldier, a real tremendous tragedy for him. That incident I remember very clearly.
Seemingly he acted instinctively, though, when he saw the sailor in difficulties.
Mm, exactly. And, and my opinion, he was deserving of a decoration for what he did.
Were these exercises dangerous? Did you have casualties and lose?
Oh, yes, we did. Yes. They were highly dangerous. I mean, in the middle of the night in January, in the North Sea off Inverness, in an open boat, ships used to run into each other and damage each other. I don't believe we did lose any chaps from sunk tanks.
Did you have any cases of chaps having to use their Davis escape gear to get out of drowned tanks?
Certainly we did on the Normandy landing, but I don't remember it being used in Scotland. It could have been, I don't remember it.
Were these exercises progressive? Did they become steadily more difficult?
Yes, and steadily more people involved. Yes. I mean, I think the first ones were perhaps on a smaller scale, and then gradually the whole blooming Tamasha was involved.
Building up. And one of the things about exercises, they can be rehearsal exercises or purely training, or they can be partly experimental with people trying out techniques and learning lessons. What sort were these? Was there any element of experimentation in them, or were they rehearsals?
Certain amount was, yes. To see what the vehicles were capable of. And it wasn't only the DD tanks, of course, it was the waterproofing of the tanks, and the ones that didn't swim were waterproofed.
The waders.
The waders, a whole squadron of waders, Delaval Cotters.
You mentioned that there was a decision taken that only two squadrons would be swimmers and the other would be waders. Do you think that was a good decision?
I do. I mean, I think, in the event the beach wasn't all that big, for all the volume of traffic it was required to take, and I think two squadrons of DD was just about right.
You said that things started getting building up, and the whole Tamasha was there eventually. This would involve getting to know your infantry in the 3rd Division. How did you get on with them? What impression did you get of the 3rd Division?
Oh, they were very good. They were good, solid county regiments of the best possible kind, I would have said. But we didn't see a great deal of them. We saw much more of the navy of our captains, of our LCTs, who were very new to the job. And I mean, the LCTs arrived, I think, from America, probably, and most of them had about maximum of 6 weeks training on them.
That would seem then that these exercises were training exercises for them rather than rehearsal exercises.
I think they had to serve both roles at the same time.
When you were doing these landing exercises, did you ever have simulated or actual live coastal bombardment from the support group?
Simulated. And a certain amount of aircraft activity, too. And there was a good deal of noise.